Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on property is the holy grail of law when we come back. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist the evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies, multinational corporations, the lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution, which was designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, is called the judicial power. Now, the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, liberties, and property. It's not the Congress, and it's not the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant, nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights, not to someone who is indifferent thereto, because it's a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. It cannot be claimed by an attorney or a solicitor, and it's valid only when insisted upon by a belligerent claimant in person, so says U.S. versus Johnson. And that's why I contend that we should be listening more to our judges and a whole lot less to our politicians and lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or your solicitor. Your rights are only claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy, our procedure, and procedure is our school available on compact disc, which deals with this thing of education on rights. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Okay, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, we've been talking about property being the holy grail of law. There's another facet to this thing of property, and it's called the subject of property. I want to write that down. The subject of property. When we look up property in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, we find a paragraph in here that talks about the subject of property. Now, it's easy to understand and comprehend property being the watch on your wrist, the automobile in your driveway, the house that you're living in. Those are tangible objects that we can see, that we can feel, touch, we recognize them, and we see the word property attached to those things. But property goes beyond things. You've also got property rights in incorporeal hereditaments. Remember, corporal is what we can see, and incorporeal is something that we don't see. It isn't something that you can taste, touch, feel, or smell. Let's take a look at a couple or three here. The subject of property. Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks. Remember the famous black lady riding the front of the bus? She was exercising a right, and that right was property. And that right, that property right that she had, had to do with a discriminatory policy that was being inflicted against her. And while she probably didn't know the difference between incorporeal and corporeal property rights, or the subject of property versus property, she was selected by the NAACP and the ACLU to act as the goat in a legal test to test the constitutionality of that law. Now, down in Alabama, they had a law on the books that, as I recall, they put on the books in 1828. So from 1828 to 1959, they had a law there that required that blacks ride the back of the bus. And I imagine somebody tested that law or tried it a couple of three times throughout the ages. I don't know if they did or not, but typically that'll happen from time to time when somebody gets arrested or jailed and there's a litigation. There's usually somebody that comes along and raises a constitutional question. They say this law is unconstitutional, either on its face or as it's being applied to me in this case. And so if the case had been tested in the past and upheld, well, then the law was constitutional. But laws can be declared to be unconstitutional at some other point in time, and that's what happened in 1959. So when you're exercising a right, That's a property right, and it involves your right to property, and that's why it's called the Holy Grail of Anglo-Saxon administration. So, a couple of examples. You have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, pursuit of happiness in the United States is construed to be property. But it isn't just your right to pursue automobiles and houses and dollars in the bank. It's also your right to pursue happiness. Happiness. Riding the front of the bus was happiness to this lady. And she wanted to pursue that happiness. And although it wasn't something that you could put your finger on and say, well, look at this watch on my wrist. This is my property. She had a property right in her happiness. And somebody was interfering with her happiness. And she said, well, now I want to go in and do a litigation here. I want to take this up to the Supreme Court and say, wait a minute. Now, this is a discriminatory policy against a suspect classification of persons. At least they were at that time. And we need a policy. We need a remedy for this wrong so that I can pursue my happiness. Okay, now that's got a lot of pregnant possibilities. I mean, a lot of pregnant possibilities. Let's take a look at another one here. It's the Los Angeles Seventh-day Adventist takings case. Now, the Fifth Amendment guarantees us in our country and around the world, when governments want to take your property, they want to take your house, and they want to use it for some very worthy public purpose over here, they need to pay you for that. Now, governments are notorious about stealing people's properties from them, but you know, even the United Nations Charter, you know, guarantees you certain rights, human rights, and this is inscribed in law, and a lot of this comes from the Bible. It's God Almighty Himself requiring that the rulers and magistrates of the world first of all recognize and obey all of the Ten Commandments. Now, they don't, and we all know that, but they have to whether they like it or not. And if you make a demand upon those governments, whether they be in Russia or China or someplace else, you'll find that there's a legitimate claim supported by the United Nations and God Almighty Himself in these things called declarations of human rights. Now, of course, for practical purposes, that doesn't apply to about 99% of people on planet Earth because they don't know how to apply those rights or how to go get those rights, those properties, enforced. And remember that if you've got a right, and in this country we have 1,100 of them, and you don't know what it is, and you don't know how to enforce it, then it's of no value to you and you don't have any rights. And it's that way around the world. Now, in your country, wherever it is, you know, you're living in Singapore or Hong Kong or you're in Japan or Brazil or Bolivia, or I don't care where you're at. The United Nations Charter applies to everybody on planet Earth. And if it doesn't, take a look at the people that are over here in Balfour over in Sudan. They've got rights that could be enforced. They could be enforced in the World Court. They could be enforced locally in the Sudan. But they don't know how. They don't know what to do. And so they're out there crying and they're in concentration camps or whatever it is, and there's news articles, and it's on the TV constantly, and there's never any resolution to it. And let's see if we can't help you with a resolution. Let's take a look at one of these incorporeal rights. It's called the takings action. And governments quite often take people's property, or they attempt to. And then when they attempt to, then somebody stands up, and they litigate, and they fail, then that case becomes a landmark decision for the rest of us to follow. And every country has these landmark decisions. Sometimes they come out of the past. We have landmark decisions that come from Henry VIII in England, still applicable today in Canada and Australia. Do you know that? There's certain basic principles of law, codes, and conducts. And so here's the story. The Seventh-day Adventists in Los Angeles, California, buy a piece of property. I think it was 7 acres, and they're making payments on it. And someday they hope to build a church on this property. But meanwhile, they're just making payments on the land. And some time goes by, and pretty soon the city council takes a look at this property, which happens to be, I think, along the Los Angeles River or something like that. And it's in what they determined to be a floodplain. And so they say, well, wait a minute, you can't build on this property. You can use this property, you know, in this area for picnics, and you can use it for parks, and you can play on it, and you can do all these things, but you just can't build on it. And so the people that had bought this property, and we're talking, you know, years ago, but we're talking about $200,000 or $300,000, you know, which at that time was a lot of bread. And so some time goes by, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church wants to build on this property. They go down to City Hall, and they say, hey, give us a building permit so we can build our church. And the people down at City Hall say, oh, no, you can't build on that property. You can walk on it, and you can look at it, and you can have picnics on it, and you can just do all these wonderful things, but you can't build your church on it because, you see, we've determined that this is a floodplain. And we want to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help. And we want to protect you people from drowning and excessive property damage. And so, therefore, we're not going to give you a building permit and go to hell and you can't build on the property. So the Seventh-day Adventist Church sued the city of Los Angeles and took this case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what this is called is an inverse condemnation. inverse condemnation is a property right that's being taken, an incorporeal property right being taken, but not directly. See, if the city came over and took the property and built a city park on it, now that's, you know, that's pretty palpable. You can see that. But when the city comes along and takes your property by ordinance and says, well, you can't do with your property what you want to do with it. You know, you want to build a church on it, and they're sitting there saying, well, no, you can't build a church on it. Now, there's an important caveat here you should be aware of. This law was enacted after they bought the property. Now, if you buy property and it's already zoned, and this is why it's important for you to check the zoning on the property before you buy, because you may find that this property is zoned or that there are restrictive covenants on the property, which is a contract which involves other people's incorporeal rights. See how that works? So if that's the case, then you're dead in the water because it's a mere question of regulation. But the Seventh-day Adventist Church prevailed, and this is one of those landmark cases on inverse condemnation. You can't do that. Now, governments do this all the time. There are literally thousands and thousands of people all over America, and I wouldn't doubt but what, they're all over the world, whose property is being taken either directly or indirectly by governments. And these people are suffering losses and don't know how to recover. But I just wanted to point out to you that you've got a property right there. And if you want to litigate, you more than likely will prevail if you know how to do it. All right, so there's the Seventh-day Adventist taking story. Rosa Parks, remember that lady? She enforced a right, and a right is a property. It is the subject of property. And this subject of property is very important. Let me give you another illustration here. An old buddy of mine, Peter Watt, bought a house in Bellwood Estates. Now, Bellwood Estates is governed by restrictive covenants. And when you buy into one of these gated communities with restricted covenants, you sign a contract. And this contract is binding upon you and upon your house and your property and property rights and what you want to do or can't do. Now, for instance, in this subdivision, they had a committee. I don't know who was on the committee or how it came about. I imagine you vote them in every once in a while. And if you've got complaints, you take it to the committee. It's the property owner's committee. And they discuss these restrictive covenants. There's a contract involved in buying the house. When you buy the house, you sign up to these restrictive covenants. Here's a couple of them. You couldn't paint your house garish yellow. Now, you know, normally when you want to paint your house, you go down to the, you know, you sit down with your wife and you say, what color do we want to paint the house? And then you come up with a couple of three ideas, and then your wife vetoes that and says, this is the color we're going to paint it. Is that how that works? And then your wife goes down to the paint store, and she agonizes for hours and hours and brings home painting samples of little subtle tinges of color change that are so minute that you need a spectroscope to tell the difference between 6214 and 6215. But, you know, and she agonizes over these colors, you know, for days and days, if not weeks and weeks, and finally comes up to a conclusion that she wants to paint this Sherwin-Williams 6204 yellow. So, oh, wait a minute, lady. Hang on a second. Don't you know that you live in Bellwood Estates and that this color has to be approved by the building or the community committee? Because there was a guy that painted his house purple. Now, I don't know if purple is a good color to paint your house. You know, if I saw some guy paint his house purple, I'd probably have an opinion. I drive down the street like everybody else, and I see people's houses. Sometimes they're yellow, sometimes they're red, sometimes they're white. Now, when I was a kid, all houses were painted white. I don't know why, but all houses were painted white. And it was sometime after World War II that we started seeing houses painted other colors. And when we saw these other colors, it kind of caught on. And so then it was white, but it was a different color of white, you know, dirty white, off-white or something. Yeah, but anyway, this guy painted his house purple. And somebody in the community went over there and they said, wait a minute, you can't do that. You didn't get approval from the Bellwood Estates committee over here. And they made him paint his house a different color. So he's paid his money and had it painted purple. And then he woke up one day. There was another guy there that put the asphalt shingles on his house. His house needed to be roofed. And so the standard in the community here was shingles or cedar shakes. You had a choice of roofs. You could either have shakes or shingles. Now, that costs a lot of money. And so when this guy built his house here in Bellwood Estates, he evidently didn't pay attention to the covenants, the restrictive covenants, and so he put on asphalt shingles. And sure enough, somebody complained to the committee, and they came after him, and they said, now listen, son, you cannot have asphalt shingles. Even though it's a brand-new Johns Manville 20-year guaranteed house, and the shingles came from Thriftway Lumber Company, and they were put on by a licensed bonded contractor, by God, not here in Bellwood Estates. And so he had to put on another roof on top of the roof he's already got on there, and it had to be done with shakes and shingles, or shingles, I've forgotten which he elected. But so there you are. Now, those are called restrictive covenants. Now, those restrictive covenants are property rights for all of the people in the community. And you cannot impose your will on your house in that community upon all the rest of the people that live around there. Isn't that amazing? That's what contract law does to you. I mean, a contract is law. And these contracts, these laws, in this case a restrictive covenant, may work against you. So you ought to be aware of when you're building and buying, you know, are there any restrictive covenants? Are there easements? Are there zoning and planning regulations? See, if your city has adopted zoning and planning, and almost all cities do, not all, but nearly all, what you have here is a system of restrictive covenants. And you need to be aware of that. Otherwise, you know, you could get caught up and that cost you some money. So there's that story. That's a case where restrictive covenants come into play and they work against you. And let's take a look now at another case, Bonnie Foster and Gary Shell. One time I had a store in Boise, Idaho, and it was located on the wrong side of the tracks, down on the south side of Front Street. And my building was so far off of Front Street that it was hard to see. And when you're advertising, when you're a businessman and you're advertising, you want your store to be, you know, on the corner of Curtis and Fairview, so that everybody in town is going to pass by it twice a day, whether they like it or not, on their way to work or wherever they're going. But I was on the wrong side of the tracks down in the warehouse districts. And so my location was fairly hard to see or to find. And people would tell me, you know, well, I've been looking for you for a long time here, Mr. Gordon, I couldn't find you. Now, right across the street was a furniture store called Foster's Warehouse Furniture. And it was about, I don't know, three or four stories high. It was a big, tall building. It was an old warehouse, but it was a big, tall building. And Bonnie Foster and her husband had a furniture store there. And old man Foster died. And old Bonnie and her daughter were running this furniture store. And they'd run their ads, and they would say, Foster's Warehouse Furniture, on the railroad tracks. Well, you couldn't miss Foster's because their building was so tall, see? And my building was a short, stubby building on the other side of Foster's, further off of Front Street, see? Harder to see. So I funked that over for a while. Now, here's Bonnie Foster, and her ads on radio and TV are just so easy to find Foster's Warehouse Furniture. And it's so hard to find Waterbed Warehouse. And so and I said, okay, Waterbed Factory, rather. Our store was called Waterbed Factory there. And so I got this brilliant stroke of genius one night about 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, what I need to do is to paint my building a new color that can be seen from a long ways away, you know, like Front Street. So I selected Caterpillar Yellow. I mean, the most garish, god-awful caterpillar yellow color you can get. A color that would grab you 40 miles away. And so I hired a painting contractor, and I paid him a bunch of money to come down here and paint my warehouse. And paint it caterpillar yellow. And the big day arrived, and here comes the big trucks, and they've got their spray painters and scaffolding out there, and got there just painting away. And well, Bonnie Foster came over. I was standing in my parking lot, you know, and Bonnie Foster came over. Now, Bonnie Foster was an older lady, see, and I'm sure she was a nice lady, but she's the kind of woman that would strike terror in the hearts of every kid in Corbell. I mean, she was like my Aunt Bessie. You know, she just struck terror in you. So remembering that from my childhood, you know, when Mrs. Foster came over, I addressed her as Mrs. Foster, not Bonnie. Because, see, I tested that in addressing your elders by their first name when I called my dad Flash one time. Hey, Flash. And I only called my dad Flash one time in my lifetime, because the pain and the anguish was so great that and the correction was so swift and severe. I always remember that. Never call your dad Flash. Never call your dad by his first name. And so anyway, when Bonnie came over, you know, I was careful to address her as Mrs. Foster. And she said, Oh, Mr. Gordon, may I have a word with you? She's a very proper lady. And so I said, well, of course, Mrs. Foster. What can I do for you? And she said, I see that you're painting your building. And I said, yes, I'm painting the building. The paint was peeling off of it, and then it needed painting, and so I decided to paint it. And she said, now, Mr. Gordon, don't you think that that color is garish? Now, I didn't know what garish meant, see, but I didn't want to let on, you know, that I was dumb. So I said, well, do you think that it's garish? And she said, oh, yes. And then she pointed to her building, which was done in earth tones, you know, brown and subtle grays, and that all of the paint colors so carefully interwove themselves with the earth tones. And she pointed out how expertly her building had been painted. And I wouldn't doubt it, you know. I mean, her building looked real good. I didn't deny it. And she pointed out that if on our building over here, that if we were to use the same kind of earth tones, I always remember Bonnie Foster, earth tones. If I'd use earth tones, you know, to paint my building, you know, it would fit in better with the community, better with the neighborhood, better with the other buildings. She pointed to the restaurant behind me, and she pointed across the street to Eichhorn's Printing, and pointed with great pride to her building over here. And so I said, well, you know, I feel real bad here painting my building a color that doesn't fit in with the rest of the community. And I said, now, does that color offend you, Mrs. Foster? And she said, yes, I am offended by that color. And I said, well, now that's the last thing in the world that I want to do, is to offend my neighbors. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Mrs. Foster, you've convinced me. I want you to go over there, that's the painting contractor over there, that man that's leaning up against his pickup. I want you to go over there to that painting contractor and tell him that this building is garish, that color will never do, and that you want him to stop right where he's at, and that you want to go down and pick out the right colors and have him paint this building any color you want, Mrs. Foster. I don't care what color you paint it, as long as you pay for it. And there was this long, pregnant pause. And Mrs. Foster left. And she didn't go over and talk to the contractor. And she didn't order the earth tones. And I take it that she evidently did not want to pay for the colors that she wanted to impose upon me. I thought caterpillar yellow was a real cool color, and I thought it would accomplish my goal of setting my building out so that everybody from Salt Lake City to Spokane, Washington could see my building from Front Street. Hell, when I got through with it, you could see it from downtown Salt Lake City, let me tell you. But Bonnie Foster now wanted to impose upon me her colors and her views, but she didn't want to pay for it. And that's my point. Everybody wants to impose upon you their thinking, their colors, their values, but they don't want to pay for it. They want you to pay for it. They want their color at your expense. They want their roof at your expense. And I'm sitting here saying, hey, wait a minute. How about my property rights? How about my caterpillar yellow color? Huh? How about that? I know it's a wild new concept for most of you people out there, but tuck it away in your heart. And let me give you a mid-course reminder here while we're at the mid-course for all the FCCs and all the rest of the bureaucrats around the world so that we can identify ourselves here and remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements and recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing and recommending will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look here at the subject matter we're talking about here is the property rights that we have, which are called the subject of property. Subject of property, you might want to write that down. You look that up in the law dictionary and you'll find that in addition to things, there's also property in your rights. Your rights are also property. Now, there's a parable in the Bible that deals with this thing of rights. It's called the parable of the vineyard. And rights come from the Ten Commandment model. Privileges come from the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto. But when we're talking about rights, we're talking about, well, this is the color that I want to paint my building, and the rest of you can like it or lump it. Okay, now that's a right. Now, when you have restrictive covenants and there's a building ordinance or code or something like that that prohibits you from painting your house the color you want or putting the roof on that you want or something like that, then that impairs your rights. It says to you that you can't exercise, you can't use your property the way you want to use it. And the use of property is that right that you're trying to protect. It is a right, and it's a property, and a property is something that can't be taken away from you. So if you have a property, then that's yours, and you can burn it, you can eat it, you can destroy it, you can cultivate it, you can do whatever in the hell you want to do with it. That's property, and that's protected by thou shalt not steal. The fundamental law that protects property is thou shalt not steal. Now, the first plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the abolition of all right to property, and that's what most of us in the world practice. Now, communism has been bandied about, and it's so pervasive now that it's everywhere. Everywhere. And so while they don't ban you from having an automobile, they regulate it to such a degree that for practical purposes, you can't use it the way you want to. Gun control legislation does the same thing. You've got a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, but it's so heavily regulated that for practical purposes, you can't do what you want. Now, these regulations over here are constitutional and lawful, at least they are in the United States, but not always. Not always. Sometimes these laws impair your right to property, and they're unconstitutional. But most people don't want to challenge the law. So when an unconstitutional law is put on the books, most people follow it. They bitch about it. They complain, and they cry a lot. But they go along with it because they don't want to challenge it. Now, once in a while, a Rosa Parks comes along and says, hey, wait a minute. You know, albeit late in the game, 128 years later. But, you know, at least at some point in time, somebody said, hey, wait a minute. Now, I mentioned this the other day. I'll mention it once more before we get into this parable over here. But vagrancy. Vagrancy. See, it impacts upon poor people. See, all the rich people you know of the world, they've got $20 in their pocket or $5. When I was a kid, if you didn't have $5 in your pocket, my dad always taught me. He said, son, never leave the house without $5 in your pocket. Otherwise, you know, you could get picked up for vagrancy. I mean, it was a big deal when I was a kid. But in 1964, that vagrancy law was struck down as being unconstitutional. It's a discriminatory policy against poor people. Why should you have to have $5 in your pocket to keep from being thrown in jail? It's just an excuse to throw you in jail. See, you're poor, so we're going to throw you in jail. It's to get the winos and the poor white trash off the streets. That's the objective of it. That helps people like Bonnie Foster keep up the image, you know. Now, there's a story here that deals with property and property rights in this parable of the vineyard. It comes from the Bible, which is the sole source of property and property rights on planet Earth. Everybody else is practicing the Babylonian mystery religion and the abolition of property and property rights, but not God, not in the Bible. Here's where property comes from. This guy, he's got a vineyard, and he wants to do some work in his vineyard, but he needs to hire some people to do that. So he goes out into the marketplace one day, and he says, hey, you guys over there, come over here. Let me pitch a deal to you. I got some work to do. I got a day's worth of work to do. I want to start at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we'll finish at 6 o'clock at night. We're going to work through the heat of the day. And I want to hire about 5 or 6 of you guys over there to come over to my vineyard and help me prune it and get it back into condition, see? And so they want to know, well, how much you paying? He says, I'm paying a penny a day. And so they thunk it over a little bit, and they said, okay, well, we'll sign up. So he's made a contract with these guys. So let's understand something about contract. All contracts have 4 elements. Listen to this now. Write it down. 4 elements to a contract. It's an offer. And this guy came into the marketplace and made an offer. It's followed by an acceptance. And these people came up with an acceptance. They accepted the offer. And there was consideration. And then the consideration was a penny a day. And there's a time element. And then it's tomorrow that we're going to do this work. Tomorrow, 6 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. That's the time element. All right. So a contract has these 4 elements. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. So he contracted with these guys a property right. Property. Now, these people have a property right in their wages and in the terms and conditions of this contract in the same way that the owner of the vineyard has a property right in the terms of the contract and the work to be done in his vineyard. That's what a contract is. It's a property. Now, law, when laws are enacted, your legislature makes a law, that's a property. There's property rights involved here, both for you and for the government, anybody else that may be the subject, or in some cases may be the object of this statute, rule, regulation, custom, usage, or practice. So the next day comes along at 6 o'clock in the morning, these guys all show up and they go to work. And everybody's working away, but the owner of the operation now, he takes a look at the work and the progress that's going on, and he comes to a conclusion. He says, you know, 6 guys, it isn't enough. I don't have enough labor here to get this job done today. So he determines, well, I know what I'll do. I'll go down to the marketplace, and I'll see if I can hire some more guys. He goes down the marketplace and says, hey, you guys over there, you ain't working. And they said, well, no man has hired us. And he says, well, go into my vineyard and work. And whatsoever is right, I'll make right with you. I'll just make it right. They don't agree to a set wage. It's left open. You know, it's just kind of an open-ended. They actually don't have a contract because they actually don't have the terms and conditions spelled out as to what the consideration is. There's no consideration here. We don't actually have a contract. We kind of have a contract, but it isn't quite a contract. Now, with the original guys, we have a contract. But not with the guys that show up at 9 o'clock. About noon, he comes to the same conclusion. Hey, I ain't got enough guys. So he goes back to the market and says, hey, and you guys want to work? He says, go into my vineyard and I'll make it right with you. Again, he hires some guys at noon. Doesn't have a contract. It's just an open-ended agreement. And hey, want to go work? And they go out and they work. So at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he does the same thing. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he does the same thing. Now, the guys that he hires on at 5 o'clock, you know, to help pick up the rest of the stuff and throw it on the fires, they're only going to work an hour, about 1/12 of a day. The guys that show up at 3 o'clock are going to work for about 3 hours. So they're going to work about 25% of a day. The guys that are there at noon, they're going to work about a half a day. The guys that arrive at 9 o'clock, they're going to work about 3/4 of a day. And the guys that arrive at 6 o'clock are going to work a full day. So you can see here that We have different arrangements here with different people that are working here on the project. Okay, so, you know, the end of the day comes, and so he tells the foreman, he says, line all these people up. And he says, start with the people that got here at 5 o'clock. And then the people that got here at 3 o'clock, and then the people that got here at noon, and the people that got here at 9 in the morning, and then the last six guys, the guys I contracted with yesterday, line them up at the end. So he starts off with the guys that have worked 1 hour, and he pays them a penny. He gives them the same amount of money that he contracted the day before with these other six guys for a penny for the whole day. They worked 1/12 of a day. They got paid a full day's wage. Naturally, the guys that had worked for a full day looked at that and said, wow. If these guys that worked 1 hour get paid one penny, and we worked 12 hours, then we must be going to get paid 12 pennies. So the next group comes in, and they worked from 3 o'clock on, 25% of a day, and he paid them a penny. Remember, he didn't have a contract with them. He had an offer. He made the offer. They accepted. And there was a time, and the time was, go into the vineyard today, but there was no consideration. He said, I'll pay you what's fair. You know, I'll make it worth your while. I'll do the right thing. But they didn't have a contract. They didn't have the four elements to a contractor. These guys didn't have a property right. But he paid him a full day's pay. Okay, then the guys at noon and the guys at 9 o'clock showed up. He pays those guys a penny. Now, the guys that had worked through the heat of the day, they complained about this. He paid them a penny, and they filed a labor grievance with the shop steward. They said, this is an unfair labor practice. This is BS. And so they haul him into court. See? And so the owner of the vineyard, in his defense, he said, now, wait a minute. Didn't we agree to a penny? So he brings up the terms of the contract, and he says, didn't we agree for a day's work, 6 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, 12 hours for one penny? And on cross-examination, they all admitted, yes, yeah, that's true, we did. And he said, at the end of the day, did I pay you that penny that I had agreed to? And they again, on cross-examination, they all reluctantly agreed, yes, that's true, you did pay us what you agreed to, one penny. And he said, well, then what the hell's your bitch? What are you complaining about? Isn't my property, isn't that which is mine to dispose of any way I want to? And if I want to pay a full day's wage to a man that has only worked for 1 hour, what business is that of yours? That's my money, that's my property, and I can dispose of it my way. I could give it to the Salvation Army. I could put it in the bank. I could spend it on a wild woman and song. And what's that to you? Now, there's your classic example of property and property rights, called the parable of the vineyard. Now, he didn't cheat anybody. He paid them what he had agreed to. Now, today, if you did that, oh, my God, the hue and cry. It's discrimination. It's unfair, especially if the six guys that you hired when you started were black and then all the rest of them were white. Can you imagine the outcry that would come from that, you racist SOB, huh? Doesn't have anything to do with race. It has to do with property and property rights. Okay, if he don't want to pay black people as much as whites, that's his choice in life, isn't it? You don't have to agree to work. None of those people had to show up. None of those people had to contract for a penny a day, but they did. And when they got through at the end of the day, they got paid just exactly what the agreement was. Now, what if he'd tried to pay them a half a penny? What if he'd have said, well, I ain't going to pay you guys? No, no. No, you can't do that because, you see, the other side of the contract, they have a property right. And they have to be paid a penny. They can't be paid less than a penny. They got to be paid that full penny. Could the guy have paid them 12 cents? Sure, he could have if he wanted to. But the fact that he didn't is irrelevant and immaterial. They'd agreed for a penny, and that's what he paid. That's what property and property rights are all about, boys and girls. So let's wake up to the realities. Now let's take a look at another one here. One time, I had a case come up. It's called Judge Hamilton and the Judgment Debtor Hearing. And this lady, she's a lady judge, and she was having some problems with me, and I didn't have a driver's license, and they arrested me, and they brought me in before the judge. And so she said, I'm going to fine you the maximum fine, which is $300. And she said, okay, for driving without a driver's license, the fine is $300. I said, okay. So I went out, and I got in line. And the guy that takes your fines, his name was Marshall Riggs. That isn't that he was a marshal. His name was Marshall. I always thought he was a marshal. I called him Marshall Riggs. And he was the bailiff, you know. But I thought he was like a U.S. Marshal, you know, like Matt Dillon. I thought this was Matt Dillon here, but no, his name was Marshall. So Marshall Riggs was his name. And he said, uh-huh, Mr. Gordon, well, are you going to pay that $300 fine today? And when he asked me that question, I said to myself, now, wait a minute, he wasn't in the courtroom this morning. And yet he knows that the fine is $300. So right away it tipped me off that he and the judge had had a conversation and that she had told him that she was going to fine me the full $300. Now, here's this $300 fine. Now, most people, they just walk up and pay their $300 fine. Now, the marshal said, are you going to pay that today? And I said, no, sir. And he said, well, then when are you going to pay it? And I said, just as soon as I get it. And he said, well, then you need a payment agreement. And I said, no, sir. And he said, well, now, if you're not going to pay that today, then you have to sign a payment agreement. And he pulled out the payment agreement, and he slipped through the cage, that little cage there, you know, window. And I said, well, it would be all right if I read this before I signed it. And he said, yeah, yeah. So I got out of line. I went over and sat down, and I read this this contract with the state. It's a contract with Ada County, Idaho, agreeing to pay them the $300 fine and so on over time at $50 a month or whatever you write into the forms, and then you sign it. This is a contract. What we're dealing with here, contract. Hey, wait a minute. Hey, we're dealing with a property right here, aren't we? Property is involved here. My labor, my money, my time. Well, now here's the state. Now, they've imposed a fine. See, they said, well, you broke our rules, and we want you to pay us this fine, and we want you to sign this contract with us and agree to pay this fine. And I thought about that, and I said, I really don't want a contract with the state of Idaho, and I don't want to pay this fine. See, now if I sign this contract over here, that's my seal of approval. So what's going to happen if I don't sign it? So I went back online when it was my turn again. He says, okay, have you signed it? And I said, no, sir. I've decided after having read it and given it careful consideration that I don't want to sign this agreement, this contract. And he said, you have to sign the agreement, pay the $300, or go to jail for 30 days. He said, which do you want to do? I said, let's see. Now my choices are, pay the $300 today, which I don't want to do. Or I can sign this contract and pay over time, which I don't want to do. Or I can go to jail for 30 days, which I don't want to do. So I said, I don't want to do any of those three options. And he got a little snippy with me, and he said, well, just what is it that you want? And I said, I want to walk out that door over there and leave you people behind and forget you ever existed. And he said, well, that ain't going to happen. And he said, don't you leave this courthouse until you have either signed the payment agreement or paid the fine or surrendered yourself for jail. I said, would it be all right with you if I thunk this over a little bit? And he said, you sit down over there. So I went over onto the bench again, and I sat down. Now here's my options. So I sat there for a while, and I said, well, I wonder how long I'll have to sit here. And he said, you have to surrender yourself for jail. No, I refuse to do that. You have to sign the payment agreement. I refuse to do that. Or you have to pay the $300, and I refuse to do that. Now, I didn't refuse to pay the $300. I said, I don't have it. And I didn't. I made it a point to be in court that day with no money. So I said, well, at 4:30 this afternoon, they're going to close this building. Are they going to leave me sitting here on the bench? You know, I guess the threat is, the subtle threat is, they're going to arrest me and take me to jail. He didn't say he was going to arrest me and take me to jail. He said he wanted me to surrender myself. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to make you take me by force. I'm going to make you come over here and grab me and handcuff me and haul me away. All right, so I'm arguing a property right here. So after a while, I couldn't stand it anymore. So he came over to me and he said, okay, you're going to have to go talk to the judge. She has scheduled a judgment debtors hearing. So I went inside and she asked me a bunch of questions. She has about 25 questions, standard question, in a judgment debtors hearing. And she said, are you refusing to pay this just debt that you owe to the state of Idaho? And I said, oh, no, ma'am. No, no. No, I'm not refusing to pay this just debt that I owe to the state of Idaho. And she said, now, why are you refusing to sign this payment agreement? And I said, because I don't want a contract with the state. And she was kind of surprised. And she says, do you want to go to jail then in lieu of paying the $300 fine? I said, no, no. Don't throw me in jail because I'm poor. That's peonage. That's debtor's prison. And she said, well, do you want to surrender yourself to jail? And I said, no, no. I don't want to volunteer to go to jail. So she asked me if I had a job and if I had any money, if I had a house, if I had any bank accounts. You know, they asked all these questions. Do you have any unemployment insurance or workman's compensation? No, no, none of the above. She said, are you looking for work? I said, no. She said, why aren't you looking for work, Mr. Gordon? And I said, because I'm unemployable. And she said, why are you unemployable? Now listen up, boys and girls. Pay attention. I said, the reason that I'm unemployable is because I don't have a Social Security number. I don't have a Social Security number. And the judge warned me. She said, now, I can bring you back here to a judgment debtors hearing every 30 days until this debt is paid. I said, okay. You have to be prepared to come back every 30 days for the rest of your life to answer the judgment debtors questions, just in case you ever change your status. But you see, if you're unemployed or unemployable, you ain't never going to come up with $300, and there's no debtors' prisons in the United States of America. And as far as I know, not in any country in the world can you throw people in jail for debt. Violates the United Nations Charter on Human Rights. Well, I'm out of time here again, boys and girls, so let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.